Hundreds of thousands of women marched across Illinois this past weekend from Chicago to Carbondale with messages of celebration and protest.
Happy anniversary. Yeah! Who knew it would just take 1 year to shut down the government?
Those were organizers of one march in Springfield via Facebook. We talk about the others around the state and hear from one Chicagoan who says we need more women managing political campaigns. Also, why a group of Chicago hospitals are getting into the housing business to help those who are chronically homeless. And we enter day three of the government shutdown. Here's Illinois Senator Dick Durbin on Meet the Press yesterday.
This is the fourth CR this fiscal year. For those who are not following the insides of Washington politics, it means a failure to pass a budget for the United States of America.
We talk Washington and Illinois politics. It's all coming up this hour on the 21st, just after the latest news.
Thank you for calling the Lincoln Home National Historic Site. Due to the federal government budgetary shutdown, the park is currently closed. The park will reopen at its regularly scheduled business hours once the shutdown has ended. We apologize for this inconvenience.
Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As you just heard, it's day three of the federal government shutdown. We're expecting a vote to take place soon in the U.S. Senate over the government closure, which began at midnight on Friday. Who's to blame for this began even before the official shutdown and continued over the weekend. Here's Senator Dick Durbin, number two in the Senate. He made the round of morning talk shows yesterday. He was asked on Meet the Press why he's not accepting a three-week spending plan without a long-term deal to fix the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program.
This is the fourth CR this fiscal year. For those who are not following the insides of Washington politics, it means a failure to pass a budget for the United States of America. This has to come to an end as well. There are people, even five Republicans, who voted against the closure on the continuing resolution because they're sick as well of these continuing resolutions. So you say, why don't we wait another 3 weeks, another 4 weeks? It has to come to an end, and it will, if and when the president shows the leadership that we expect of him as president.
President Trump, of course, pointed fingers right back at the Democrats, along with Republicans in the House. Late last week, Republican Congressman Rodney Davis accused Democratic leaders, including Senator Dick Durbin, of grandstanding.
Frankly, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that it's a year anniversary since President Trump was sworn into office, and it's more about messaging on their part rather than governing.
That was Republican Congressman Rodney Davis yesterday. Republicans have also accused Democrats of holding up funding for our military. But Illinois' other Democratic senator, Tammy Duckworth, took time on the Senate floor yesterday to talk about that issue.
And I will not be lectured about what our military needs by a five deferment draft dodger. And I have a message for Cadet Bonespurs. If you cared about our military, you'd stop baiting Kim Jong-un into a war that could put 85,000 American troops and millions of innocent civilians in danger.
That's Senator Tammy Duckworth on the Senate floor yesterday speaking about President Trump. Minutes ago, a statement was released by Illinois Republicans in the House, not just Representative Davis, who we just heard from, but John Shipkus, Peter Roskam, Adam Kinzinger, Randy Holgren, Mike Boss, and Darren LaHood. And it said, at noon today, Senators Durbin and Duckworth have another opportunity to allow a vote to fund our government. We are urging them to take this opportunity. With all that's going on in Washington, what's actually happening here in Illinois? Thankfully, so far, our reporting shows not too much. Of course, as you just heard, National Park Service's sites like the Abraham Lincoln Home in Springfield are shut. There are many other federal employees who aren't at work today. The Chicago Tribune reported there are some 40,000 federal workers across the metro area. And of course, only essential personnel like TSA workers at O'Hare and Midway are allowed on the job. We reached out to Head Start offices in Champaign and Bloomington. Head Start is a school care program for low-income children. They told us they were operating as usual for the moment. We wondered if having departments like the USDA shut would matter to Illinois farmers, but the Illinois Farm Bureau says so far, not much impact there as well. Even for college students, the University of Illinois tells us that students receiving Pell Grants and other loans should be fine as long as the shutdown remains short term. If you're affected by this, let us know. Give us a call at 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. Leave us a voicemail. You can also send us an email. It's talk@21stshow.org. And of course, stay tuned to this NPR station throughout the day for updates. As I said, we are expecting a vote within minutes in the Senate from on this bill. So we'll be following that during this hour. It's a busy Monday here. Hundreds of marches took place across the country this weekend on the one-year anniversary of the Women's March. In Chicago, organizers estimated approximately 300,000 people attended, more than last year. We put together some clips from many of the marches across Illinois.
We're about to march on some indigenous land here.
All right.
And I also want to say happy anniversary.
Yeah!
All right. Who knew it would just take 1 year to shut down the government?
Chicago is strong, Chicago is resilient, and Chicago knows how to woke!
My dad's Haitian, and many of his friends have gotten very affected by what he's doing to the Haitians.
Support other women who run for office and run for office ourselves will continue to be marginalized.
And today I think of the words of one of my heroines, Shirley Chisholm, who said, if they don't give you a seat at the table, you bring a folding chair.
Voices of women and men this weekend marching in Springfield, Chicago, and Carbondale. Thanks to producer Robin Lynn for producing that piece for us, that audio courtesy of WBEZ, Action Illinois, and Women United Network. One of the big questions last year in the march was how to translate that energy into political action. And many of this year's marches were dubbed March to the Polls. Have there ever been this much interest among women running for office? According to Emily's List, more than 16,000 women reached out to that site in the 9 months following the election about running for office. But maybe running for office seems like a big step. How about managing a political campaign? That's the question Chicago progressive activist Erica Sagrins posed in a recent op-ed she penned for Teen Vogue. She successfully directed State Representative Will Guzzardi's campaign in 2014. Today, she's the digital director for the National Domestic Workers Alliance, and she's on the line from Chicago. Hey, Erica, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, thanks for having me.
First, you were at this weekend's march in Chicago, right? I wonder what the atmosphere was like for you.
Yes, I was there. It was incredible. I was in D.C. last year, which was amazing, but I was really excited to be home in Chicago for it and see even more folks coming out this year.
How else did you think it was different, the two marches?
Well, the Chicago one definitely was an emphasis on voting. I mean, I think everywhere, but also here in particular, since we have primaries coming up in March, a lot of messages about power to the polls, getting out to vote, you know, harnessing the energy of the women's marches and the resistance at the polls this year.
And of course, speaking of voting, last week, very timely, you published a call for women to get involved in campaigns in ways many might not think about. Instead of running for office, running a campaign. How did you first get involved in politics?
You know, I got involved as an activist in high school and college, and then, you know, got sort of pulled into political campaigns. You know, I lived in Rhode Island, and it being a very small state, you know, ended up meeting people running for office, volunteering for them, seeing them elected to local positions and seeing them able to make a real difference. So from there, I started working in D.C., worked on Obama's campaign here in Chicago, so I ended up here. But then, you know, Chicago politics as well just got pulled in. There's, I think, a lot of opportunities. There's a lot of shaking up that needs to happen that I've seen. And so, you know, wanted to just get involved myself and then bring other folks in as well, especially women.
And your first campaign you ran was for Illinois Representative Will Guzzardi. How did that come about?
You know, I was involved as a volunteer on Will's first campaign when he ran in 2012. I wasn't able to get very involved, though, because I was also working in the Obama campaign at that time, but, you know, just volunteered for him a little bit, knocked on some doors, saw that he was really fighting the good fight and had a lot of neighborhood support, really great progressive candidate. And so in the next time he ran, I just ended up kind of asking if he had a campaign manager, kind of just feeling it out, and got really encouraged by someone who worked for him to step up into that role. I left the job that I had and decided to quit my job and do that for about 7 months. And it ended up, you know, we ended up winning. So it ended up being a really great experience and entry point into managing a campaign.
Erica, you started off your piece in Teen Vogue by saying that during the campaign, you were mistaken for Will Guzzardi's secretary and girlfriend, which I am rolling my eyes at since you cannot see. But I wonder, does that also...
They don't even have secretaries, really. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder how much that also speaks to the lack of women in these positions or working on campaigns.
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, when you see, right, when people see a young woman with a candidate, you know, what do they think? Do they think that person's in charge, or do they see her as, you know, a secretary, a girlfriend, someone who's kind of a more entry-level volunteer staffer? Often, you know, there are so many women working on campaigns in different ways, and that's another point I wanted to make, is just women really are the backbone of these campaigns, often as volunteers or as staffers, but not really seen, not really in charge, and not really seen as being the people who should be setting the strategy or running them, which is one thing that I want to change.
And you made a few other points in your Teen Vogue piece that I wanted to hit on. And one of them was that working on a campaign can be a solid career move. How so?
Well, I wanted to make the point, especially to many of the women who have gotten more politically active since 2016, that this can actually be a career. I mean, I think a lot of people start out as volunteers, knocking on doors, making phone calls, which is really important for all campaigns. But it's also something you can turn into a job and then a career. You know, if you start as a field organizer or, you know, other similar roles, you can move up. You can become, you know, a communications director, a fundraising director. And eventually, if you want to become a campaign manager or a consultant, those are, you know, there's a lot of job openings in the world of campaigns, and just want to make sure people know about that. And it's often not clear how you actually get these roles. So just want to kind of make that point and encourage people to see themselves as, you know, something they could do.
I'm speaking with Erica Sagrams about the piece that she wrote in Teen Vogue. And this is a big one, Erica. You wrote that as a woman running a campaign, you can create your own environment. And I wonder, how was the work culture that you created when you ran Will Guzzardi's campaign different from other campaigns that you worked on?
Yeah, I mean, I tried to create a culture that was, you know, very much inclusive and, you know, a positive, productive work environment for our staff and volunteers. I mean, so much of why people want to get involved in campaigns as staff or volunteers is just being part of something, being part of a community, being part of a cause that they believe in. So that's important in terms of what it feels like at the office. And right, I mean, so many work environments are very toxic for women of color, around dealing with sexism, racism. Not to say, you know, you can ever eliminate any of that completely, but just trying to make, create a work environment that really, you know, holds folks to high standards, and, you know, you're focused on winning an election, and it can be really stressful, but also is a positive environment for people to be in.
You also wrote, Erica, that women of color are the backbone of most Democratic campaigns. And I wonder how you believe women of color can come to more prominence and gain more recognition in the political sphere. And as you said, as you mentioned, even, I wonder how much running a campaign will make a difference in that arena.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing is right now is that so many women of color are really involved in campaigns and are the base. You know, Celinda Lake, the pollster, quoted her saying that African-American women are the base of the Democratic Party. And we know that's true for voters, for volunteers as well. But I think, you know, getting into roles like running campaigns will just sort of give a new level of recognition to that. I think people sort of began to, or at least there was a moment of recognizing this around the Senate election in Alabama in December, people talking about how it was Black women that really won this seat for the Democrat. But I want to, you know, make sure that people are seeing that it's not just voting and volunteering, but getting more women in positions where they're making decisions, running things, you know, highlighting them in leadership positions as well.
And what would you say to women who think, I'm not qualified to do this? In fact, that's one of the things you said. You wrote that you thought that before you ran Will Guzzardi's campaign.
Yes. I would say you should consider it, and that you may be more qualified than you think. That was what was told to me. And I already had worked in politics. But I think for many women, if you have volunteered, if you've organized events, even if they're not even political events, but, you know, events at a church or a community group, those are a lot of skills that will translate to working on a campaign or managing a campaign. And you can start at all levels. I mean, I think people see presidential campaigns, Senate races, those are really big, but there's tons of local races. There's aldermanic races, there's school board, there's state rep and Senate races. Depending on where you live, there's a whole range. So I would encourage people to really see themselves as qualified because, as I said too, there's no one skill set that you need. There's a ton of things you need to do as a campaign manager, from, you know, doing fundraising to polling to figuring out what messages should be in your field strategy. So a lot of it is figuring out how to learn on the job. So if you've done some of it and have some of a sense for campaigns or the different pieces, then I think it's something you can really learn if you're invested in it.
And why Team Vogue?
Team Vogue has a great audience of women, young women in particular. Really want to encourage them to see this as an opportunity for them, you know, both to run for office and to be leaders in campaigns.
That's Erica Sagrins. She's now the digital director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance in Chicago. She was the successful campaign manager for State Representative Will Guzzardi when he was elected to office back in 2014. And the author of this piece we've been talking about in Teen Vogue. We'll tweet it out if you haven't had a chance to read it yet. Erica, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning into the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As I mentioned, we're keeping an eye on that Senate vote in Washington on the federal shutdown. We will let you know when that vote takes place. We're expected to see that start any minute now. Whether you go to the hospital for a broken bone or a stomach bug, most of us would rather avoid an overnight stay. There's the lack of privacy, the constant check from nurses, not to mention hospital food. And for the most part, hospitals want to get you home as well. But what about patients who don't have a place to go? Chronically homeless patients are something many hospitals contend with, so much so that in Chicago, 4 hospitals have started programs to help their homeless patients find shelter. 2 other hospitals are in the planning stages. Kristen Schorsch recently wrote about this in Crane's Chicago Business. She's on the line with us from there. Hey, Kristen, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this seems like this would be an expensive venture for hospitals, is it?
Well, I mean, that's a good point. So for the University of Illinois Hospital System, for example, they spent about $250,000 to house initially about 26 patients in 2015 to 2016. So, I mean, if you think about that, I mean, that sounds like a lot of money, but if you think about the overall budget of a hospital or the cost of an ER trip, I mean, it's honestly not a lot of money. So, for example, U of I Hospital looked up the cost for about 600 of its homeless patients going back to 2016. About a third of them were the most expensive patients within the entire health system. They cost 7 to 70 times more than the average patient. So if you can find someone at home and get them stability so they don't have to worry about, you know, keeping insulin in their pocket, you know, where they're going to get their next meal, I mean, that could really chip away at the cost.
That's Kristen Shore. She covers healthcare for Crane Chicago Business and has been writing about this issue of how hospitals are trying to tackle the problem of homelessness among their patient population. We have some of the people Kristen spoke with in her story with us now. Stephen Brown directs preventative emergency medicine at the University of Illinois Hospital and Health Sciences System. He also spearheads the Better Health Through Housing program. Mary Sajak is with Cook County Health, where she's the COO of Integrated Care Services. Kim Leslie is the ER Clinical Director of Swedish Covenant Hospital. All of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Stephen, how did you first get involved with this?
Well, so we have a public health mission with a health equity mission here at the University of Illinois. It was something that we wanted to exercise. And having conducted our first what we call community health needs assessment, like all hospital, not nonprofit hospitals ever do, we're looking to say, how could we make a baby step into population health? And we knew that we had a significant amount of chronically homeless patients coming to our ER, and we were approached by the Center for Housing and Health that was looking for a healthcare partner to demonstrate what we call the housing first model. And it's a national model that's got very high retention rates, oftentimes 80% and above, for people that have might have severe mental illness and substance abuse and are homeless, because it also adds supports. So our hospital leadership decided that they wanted to invest in this. And so we worked with the Center for Housing and Health and began a process then of identifying people out of our emergency department and finding permanent supportive housing in the community for them.
And Mary, as Stephen's explaining that, Kristen explained a little bit of this. I imagine for you with Cook County Health, you serve a lot of vulnerable patients. Among your patient population, how does the lack of housing affect their ability to stay well?
It impacts it in multiple ways, and it also impacts the health system in a negative way. So for them, it may result in more trips to the emergency room. It may result in conditions that are uncontrolled that could be easily controlled. And overall, their just general health status and mental health status deteriorates over time because they are just so unwell. For the health system, these folks tend to, and Stephen can probably speak to this as well, they tend to stay in the hospital longer because dispositioning them to the street is usually not an option that the providers prefer. And so they tend to stay in longer to make sure everything is totally resolved so that if they are discharged to the street, that then, you know, the likelihood that they'll be okay is greater because all the work has been done. But in other settings, if that patient had a home to go to, then we would be able to do those things in a coordinated fashion on an outpatient basis. So this results in, you know, in our beds getting tied up, which then results in people in the emergency room.
Kim, how do you all know at Swedish Covenant, how do you know if someone is homeless? Is that something that you ask patients about? Is it something they tell you when you check in? How do you figure that out?
Quite often we don't realize it upon beginning care of the patient because when they register, they may give an address where they receive funding, quite often a church address where they stay or have correspondences go to. It's not until upon discharge that we realize when we say, oh, take your crutches or get your prescription filled, that they disclose, I have nowhere to go. Somebody's going to steal my prescription. Where am I going to get around? I have nowhere to stay. You know, such things as discharge instructions of soak your foot or use ice. And then they let us know they don't have the means.
Stephen, so with the a Better Health Through Housing program, how are you working with hospitals on, first of all, I imagine even identifying this at the front end is also an important part of this process?
Yes, it is. Most of the referrals we have come through our emergency department and our psychiatric ward, and then surprisingly, our oncology service, where we have found very high head and neck rate, rates of head and neck cancers in that population. And then we create a process then for referring them into permanent supportive housing, not necessarily on the current encounter, but we use a outreach worker from Heartland Health that goes and finds these individuals because you'll find that they tend to stay within a particular constrained geography. So we give the outreach worker a little bit of information about, for example, we had several individuals that lived on the encampment under the Dan Ryan at 18th Street, and we've found everybody in our cohort. Been able to find everybody.
And how does this work, Mary, for example, with the Cook County Hospital System? You all work with an organization called Housing Forward. How long has that relationship existed?
That relationship's been in place for a few years, and we actually just ramped up in June in order to start working with them in order to secure placement in permanent supportive housing for members who are using Cook County facilities and are also members of our health plan. So that relationship has been in place. I think there was a year of planning prior to this grant being available to us, and then it officially kicked off in June of 17.
And Kim, Leslie, for Swedish Covenant, how does it work for you all? Have you had previous existing relationships with different partners for this?
This was a new, relatively new program for us. We're learning how it goes and getting better and better at it with every client placed. We also have a field worker from Heartland who I can give as much information as I have if I don't have the patient with me presently once they're identified. He will try and reach the patient where they tend to frequent. They may know each other. Sadly, some of the patients end up being so ill on a repeat visit that they end up being admitted in the hospital, and I can make the connection that way.
Mm-hmm. And Stephen, how does this work for hospitals? How do you help them start this process and start and create these programs and these relationships?
So part of what we do then is we get them into the Center for Housing and Health. They play the leadership role in this. They have 28 different supportive housing agencies that they work with. So typically after the outreach worker has located the individual, we'll offer an SRO or a bridge unit, a single room occupancy hotel for a period of time to stabilize the person, get them into housing almost immediately. We have immediate availability in three different SROs around the city. Oftentimes, it may take a few times for that outreach worker to establish the trust for that person to know that they actually do have a place to live. Sometimes we've had it's taken 2 months before that person will accept housing, usually as because of their severe mental illness. Once they're stabilized in an SRO, then they're introduced to their permanent supportive case manager, who then begins a housing search for them. We have a pool of about 125, 150 units scattered on the northwest and south sides. Obviously not enough if we want to scale, but there's other things that are happening within the city where we should be able to have more units coming online next year.
And how many people are we talking about here, Stephen? How many people, how big is this population that you all are trying to help?
Sure. So we have 26 that we had in our first cohort. The hospital has refunded the program again, and we're expecting another 25 to 30 in this cohort. Currently within our health system, the funny thing is once you start going and looking for the homeless, you begin to find them. When I started the program, we thought we had 48. I can report now that it's well over 600 patients that are currently homeless. And if we look back through our medical records, it looks like there's evidence that we saw 3,500 patients going back to 2010.
Wow. Mary, how about you with Cook County? What are you all seeing in terms of numbers of patients?
We screen people for housing instability, and we estimate that between 20 and 25% of our patient base is unstably housed.
And Kim, what about with Swedish Covenant?
We are beginning to ask up front and ask the questions, especially with our repeat visit patients that we obviously didn't serve them if they need to return to us for their health and their emergency need. So asking up front, and a lot of ours is word of mouth now that we have the program among staff and patients, that's one of the first things we identify on someone. We have 4 placed in housing and 4 more in bridge units working on to finish up the services.
I'm speaking with, we're talking about the issue of hospitals helping their homeless patients. My guests are Stephen Brown. He's at University of Illinois Hospital and Health Sciences System. Mary Sajak is with us as well with Cook County Health, and Kim Leslie with Swedish Covenant, all in Chicago. Stephen, who's paying for this? I guess that's obviously a big question, right? As you're sort of detailing all of these services and all of these people, how are these expenses covered?
Sure. So this is through our general operating and some philanthropic funds. And I must mention that in its current form, it's unsustainable because we're in the middle of what we call the wrong pockets problem. The entities that derive the most financial benefit from this are the managed care organizations or insurance companies that are agents for Medicaid here in the state of Illinois. And so what we're now doing is showing them just how less expensive their health care costs of these chronically homeless individuals can be. And we're asking them to rebate the money that we've committed to the housing on this. And there's been some really good conversations around coming to more of a sustainable model.
Mm-hmm. And Mary, from the financial standpoint of this, I think you talked about this a little in terms of the cost. How was the breakdown when you compare the cost of housing a patient in an apartment versus caring for a patient in the hospital?
It is way less expensive, but it's more than just a cost issue. It's a quality of life issue as well. Our goal is always to get people back to the community and have them be integrated and able to succeed in the community that they're living in. So to the extent that we can make that happen, by cutting down on, their usage of medical services when to meet other kinds of needs that we're not really designed to meet, I think is just an overall win for both the patient and the health system.
Kristen Church is with us as well. She initially reported on this issue for Crane Chicago Business. Kristen, as you report out the story, did you find specific challenges with these programs? I wonder, what do you see as the biggest issues with getting these implemented?
Well, I think like Stephen pointed out, I think there is the issue of cost. Are these programs sustainable? Will the insurance companies that are implementing the Medicaid benefits on behalf of the state for them start to pay attention to see how much these costs actually drop if you find people homes? Also, I think another one of the challenges, just more broadly speaking, is why more hospitals aren't doing this. So the city of Chicago, for example, Dr. Morita, who runs the Chicago Department of Public Health, had a meeting with hospital executives several years ago and said, I'd really love you all to start to try and find housing for your chronically homeless patients. You know, showing evidence that if you do this, it will drop costs, it will drop ER visits, it will drop hospitalizations, and it will improve your quality of life. So I think that's still a big question, is why do we have so few hospitals that are actually starting these programs?
Kim, Leslie, what was it like for you all at Swedish Covenant what was it like for the staff, I wonder? You know, we've been talking about the homeless population and folks who are homeless and their care, but I wonder what it was like also for your staff when you placed your first patient in a home.
Oh, they were very excited. Of course, she was known and loved to us because she would have several repeat visits. We weren't able to get her well enough and independent enough. So to find out she had housing, we also saw goals in her. Somebody saw her leave the local grocer with some flowers. She was very pleased to be on a path to wellness finally. And it wasn't something we could treat in the emergency department alone. She needed to have housing for health.
And so I wonder, Kim, what you would say to other hospitals that maybe are thinking of having a hard time implementing this, or what advice you would have for them?
Truth be told, it is very labor intensive, and you would think if you had apartments available to patients who needed one that I'd have the line out the door, and it's not the case. Like was said, there's a trust issue. We need to gain their trust. We need them to understand that we're all in this together to help them. But the benefits, financial and the satisfaction for both the patient and the staff, that we truly are able to help these patients on the road to recovery, whether it be mental health, substance abuse, physical health, or a combination of all three, if they have a safe place to go every night.
I want to thank all of the folks involved in this conversation. From Swedish Covenant Hospital, you were just listening to Kim Leslie. She's the ER clinical director. I want to thank Mary Sajak as well. She's COO of Integrated Care Services for Cook County Health. Stephen Brown directs the Preventative Emergency Medicine Program at University of Illinois Hospital and Health Science Systems, as well as in charge of spearheading this Better Health Through Housing program that we first learned about from Kristen Schorsch. Thank you all for being with me. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks.
Also, just an update on that Senate vote has started now in regards to the federal government shutdown. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer did just urge his senators, his Democratic colleagues, to vote yes on the bipartisan compromise, he said, when it comes forward, and said in a few hours the government will reopen. We'll keep you updated on that vote. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's day three of the federal government shutdown. There's a vote underway right now in the U.S. Senate to end that. It appears, according to Democratic leader Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, that he's urging his Democratic colleagues to vote to end the shutdown. So we'll have news of that as it happens. We're not sure if that will happen in the next 15 minutes or not, but we'll keep you updated on that. We know, of course, that will still have to pass the House. And then the president will President Trump will have to sign that for the government to reopen. Of course, we've been talking a lot about Washington this hour, but there's still a lot going on in state politics. We've talked in this program on the past about Governor Rauner's amendatory veto of a bill that would pave the way for Illinois' new school funding formula. The state house still needs to act on that. Meanwhile, we know it's just 2 months away from the Democratic and Republican primaries for 2018. Next week, we are going to begin airing candidate interviews with candidates for attorney general. They will be followed by gubernatorial candidates. If you have questions, by the way, you'd like us to ask the candidates, please let us know. Email us at talk@21stshow.org. I'm joined now by Sophia Tureen, who covers politics for the AP. Madeline Dubek is the director of policy and civic engagement at the Better Government Association, veteran political reporter. Both of you, welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you, Nyla.
Madeline, can I start with you with Governor Rauner and the executive order he issued last week? It has to do with property taxes, actually, which he's talked about a lot in the past few weeks. The order says state lawmakers cannot represent clients before the state's Property Tax Appeal Board. Can you explain why the governor's doing this now, Madeline?
Well, there are policy reasons and political reasons, of course, and he's trying to, I think, draw attention to the fact that there are some key lawmakers who do property tax appeals work, chief among them House Speaker Michael Madigan, and others as well, and then up in Northern Illinois, in Cook County and Chicago, the city council's veteran finance chair, Ed Burke, also does a lot of property tax appeals work, and both of them make significant income from that work. Ironically, the governor's order would not apply to cases in Cook County or Chicago, but he is, you know, trying to essentially, from a political perspective, draw attention to this situation and, you know, try to stop those appeals from taking place with lawmakers representing people appealing to this state board.
Sophia, how much of this executive order is then the politics of it related to Speaker Madigan? And I wonder have we heard anything from the speaker since Friday, since Governor Rauner published this executive order?
So this fits into, you know, Governor Rauner back before he was governor, campaigning on, you know, what he says is a push for property tax relief. And he says that is the system that Illinois has is driving out homeowners and businesses. And, you know, it's something that Speaker Madigan has been accused of benefiting for over the years. You know, and he says he's very careful, and he doesn't, you know, personally gain from it. This bill, it's pretty narrow. It deals with the Illinois Property Tax Appeal Board. So it's this five-member board, and it only reviews cases after county boards have already made decisions. And it does something like 30,000 cases a year. The vast majority are from Cook County. And it specifically says that, you know, legislators can't get any kind of compensation, even directly. They can't represent clients before the board. So it's a, you know, Rauner has called it a clear conflict. Speaker Madigan has long maintained that he, you know, he follows the law when it comes to this.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if we could get that kind of is in the background of the governor's race, right? As you said, Sophia, this is something property taxes has been an issue Governor Rauner has talked about for a long time. But in terms of the gubernatorial race, Madeline, last week, the Rauner campaign had bought airtime for lots to play lots of unedited tape of conversations between former Governor Rod Blagojevich and J.B. Pritzker, who's running for the Democratic nomination. Madeline, can you explain what's in, what are these conversations for folks who haven't been paying attention?
Sure. So the conversations are from FBI wiretaps that were part of the FBI's investigation into activities by former Governor Rod Blagojevich. And there is several minutes of tapes that include the Democratic candidate, J.B. Pritzker, talking to Rod Blagojevich, and they're essentially talking back and forth at one point about the possibility of the sort of domino effect that occurred when Barack Obama became president and his Senate seat opened up. And so there's discussion there between Pritzker and Blagojevich about the possibility of then Governor Blagojevich appointing J.B. Pritzker to perhaps the state treasurer's office or attorney general. And so the governor has put out some ads about this previously, and J.B. Pritzker said that the conversation was taken out of context. So the governor took out even more airtime on a handful of stations around the state to play the whole, pretty much all of the tapes of the conversation between the two of them.
Sophia, how much is this going to be money versus money with Pritzker versus Rauner just kind of slugging it out over this issue? Are we going to keep hearing more about these tapes, you think, over the next 2 months?
Definitely. If there's one prediction I could make, is you're going to hear a lot about these tapes. What's surprising is that, you know, you have an incumbent Republican governor who's been dubbed the most vulnerable Republican governor in the nation. And he's got his own primary challenger now, you know, based off of some of the decisions he made that angered conservatives. And now he's going after, even before the primary has started, who he thinks the Democratic front runner is, and someone who's also a very, very wealthy businessman. So purchasing ad time, you know, the original ad, I think, was a minute or two long. He bought up segments in some markets, I mean, statewide, up to 30 minutes of airtime.
How much money is that?
That's the one thing that's a little hard to nail down. There's been it could be quite expensive. Up to 30 minutes of blocks to air these, you know, that's 11 minutes of tape and 15 minutes of commercial. And, you know, it's them talking about the appointments. It's at one point, then Governor Blagojevich brings up the possibility of donations. And you can see that J.B. Pritzker doesn't quite know how to respond and says they shouldn't be talking about that. It's already come up last week. The Chicago Tribune held an editorial board session that was live streamed, and a lot of it was attacks from fellow Democrats on Pritzker about, you know, this is business as usual in Illinois. Look, he's you know, got tied up with, you know, the former Governor Blagojevich, and the Pritzker campaign has long said, you know, there was nothing untoward about these. Hundreds of people spoke to, you know, former Governor Blagojevich. And then there's also the other question of, you know, these 2008 recordings were never played at trial. And the Blagojevich and his defense, they tried to get these types of tapes, these tapes played. And so Patty Blagojevich, his wife, has kind of been doing the media circuit saying, you know, how dare they bring this up now after he was convicted in the second trial.
Right. And so as he's still sitting in jail for that, we should point out, right? In prison,
absolutely.
Sorry.
So,
yes.
Right. And it's going to keep, you know, I think that's going to be one of their main tactics is trying to tie him to business as usual in Illinois.
And Madeline,
the suggestion being that, you know, he had access and was trying to cut an insider deal that, you know, most of the rest of us would never get a chance to weigh in on.
Mm-hmm. And Madeline, Sophia mentioned the three, we have the three top, I don't know if we want to call them the top candidates right now in terms of money and attention that they've been getting for the Democratic primary, Daniel Biss, Chris Kennedy, J.B. Pritzker, at the Chicago Tribune's editorial board on Friday, which was live stream. Lots of people paying attention to that. What did we see during that? Is sort of everyone ganging up on J.B. Pritzker, whether it's Governor Rauner or Chris Kennedy or Daniel Biss?
Well, you know, certainly there were everyone was taking some shots at J.B. Pritzker. Primarily, you know, he seems to have racked up the most endorsements. He seems to be the quote unquote establishment candidate of the Democratic Party. So you see, and he has the access to money. So that's a natural thing that you're going to see play out in a situation like that. But there, you know, there definitely was some jockeying between Senator Biss and Chris Kennedy, too, to kind of be the front runner anti-J.B. Pritzker candidate, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Sophia, as all of this is happening, there's still a state government to run. And I wanted to ask you about the amendatory veto that Governor Rauner issued. It would have allowed the new funding formula for schools to be implemented. He issued this amendatory veto saying that more needs to be done for private schools. He'd like to see some regulations changed in the way that private schools, whether and how they register with ISBE, the State Board of Education. What's supposed to happen next with this?
They've been calling it a cleanup bill. You know, so last year lawmakers approved this historic rewrite of how the state, you know, doles out public funds to schools. And a couple months later, the State Board of Elections realized that some of the numbers in the way that was written were incorrect. And to fix that problem in November, lawmakers passed a cleanup bill to kind of fix the calculations. So then comes, earlier this month that Governor Rauner uses his amendatory veto powers to rewrite a portion of that bill, not touching the calculations part, but adding in something so that there's a little lesser threshold for private schools that have not yet been included in the bill, and that's relevant because there's a tax credit now for private school scholarships. So that instead of, you know, being registered with the state, which involves a visit and paperwork, a site visit, they can now be recognized, which is more or less paperwork. And so this, you know, I think kind of came out of nowhere for a lot of people, particularly the people who negotiated on the original school funding bill. This bill is needed to fix those original calculations, but now this additional stuff has been added in. Lawmakers will have to do something, either whether it's, you know, a fresh legislation to address those calculations and to make it easier for them, some of these not yet registered with the state private schools to be able to qualify for that tax credit. Whether it's in the form of, you know, dealing with this bill, which will require a pretty high voting threshold, or if it's fresh legislation, that remains to be seen. They'll be in session next week, and next week is also the governor's State of the State address.
Right. So we'll maybe see some action on that. Madeline, before we go, I wanted to ask you about a new podcast that you're doing with the Better Government Association. It's called Ready, Set, Gov. What's that about?
Ready, Set, Gov is a new podcast the Better Government Association launched today, and you can check it out on iTunes, Google Play, or the first episode is also on our website at bettergov.org. What we want to do is try to really give people some nonpartisan, factual, expert analysis of some of the major challenges facing Illinois today. So first up, we have a conversation with Jamie Calvin, who is a community activist and the journalist who first reported on the shooting of Laquan McDonald and helped surface the information that there was a video of that shooting out there. So we talked to him about policing and justice. We also have on the podcast, on iTunes. You can listen to conversation with Linda Lenz, who's a longtime education journalist in Illinois. She kind of goes through the whole changes to school funding that we've seen, gives us the ABCs of the school funding changes that were adopted. We also have a kind of a crash course in Illinois taxes with David Merriman from the University of Illinois. So we're going to try to give people in a very short order a fast but comprehensive look at some of the major challenges we face and, kind of catch people up if they haven't always been paying attention with some unbiased expert explanation of what's going on in Illinois.
So that's called Ready, Set, Gov. It's out today. Wherever you get your podcasts, I assume, Madeline,
exactly.
On iTunes,
yep.
Everywhere as well. I want to thank Madeline Dubeck with the BGA for joining us, telling us about that. Sophia Tureen with the AP. Thank you both for being with me.
Thank you, Myla.
Just an update. Senate leaders have agreed on a plan to fund the government until February 8th. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says that in exchange for reopening the government, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has agreed to open debate on immigration by that date. The House is expected to pass this plan as well. President Trump will also need to sign it. Then the government will reopen. That does it for us today. We have lots of people working very hard on the show today. Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, Alan Montesilio, Grace Stetson is our intern, Jason Croft and Steve Moore providing technical direction and engineering. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. All the folks behind the scenes getting today's show ready. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.